Today's mailbag is from Lori. Hello, ladies. I just watched all of our children and grands drive away today around 2, and I realized that there isn't officially a Sunday basket club today. But I have struggled with a lot of derailments these past 2 years, some good, some not so good, so I just want to establish a fresh start. Praying that 2023 will be a better year and that I can accomplish lots more goals. My first goal is to keep my kitchen table clear as best as I can. It tends to be the dumping ground, and it's usually all mine. I'm posting a picture of my cleared-off table, and I will put it on my fridge to spur me on each day. I have realized, however, that it is okay if things do get derailed. The Sunday basket comes to the rescue. It has truly saved my sanity many times, and I know that it prioritizes even when I can't. I was always reassured that things were in that box if I didn't have the energy but for a couple of things. Thank you, Lisa, for creating this lifesaver and for all of you ladies who help at Organize 365.
Do you have an Organize 365 success story? If so, we would love to hear about it. Please send us an email at customerservice@organize365 and tell us how you have taken back your home, your paper, and your life with Organize 365.
Welcome to the Organize 365 podcast. I'm your host, professional organizer, productivity expert, and motivational speaker, Lisa Woodruff. This podcast will help you embrace progress over perfection and create lasting functional organizing in your home. I have so much to share with you, so let's get started. So we've talked about how everyone in the world is playing checkers with the work that we do at home, and some of us are playing the game of chess. So there's checkers, which is doing the work, and there's chess, which is strategy. And then in the next podcast episode, I talked to you about there is work. Like every home is its own economy, every home is its own business. And that you're both the CEO and the COO of your business. You may play both roles. You may have multiple adults in the household, one playing each of the roles. The CEO is in charge of all of the operations and supply chain and making sure everything gets done. And the CEO is in charge of the vision and the strategy for the people who live in the household. So with these two concepts, with these playing the game of checkers and chess or thinking about your house as an enterprise, I want to now dive in the next couple of episodes and talk about what this practically looks like in different phases of life and with different peoples living inside of the house. And I'm going to start with a mixed generation or multi-generation family. That is the family composition of our current household, but also in the Organize 365 team. Like we have 3, 4, I don't know, or more of us that are in this mixed generation family, mostly by choice. And I think actually, if you look at families around the world, I haven't done the research, but if you look at families around the world and in history, I think this was more the norm. The idea of, a couple getting married and living alone and only having their children in the house and then being empty nesters, I think that's a more recent occurrence. It's not how families used to function, and I don't necessarily know if that's how non-American or non-Anglo families actually have ever functioned. So we're going to talk about a mixed generation family first. So what does that mean? That would mean that you're having like 2 or 3 generations of people living in the same household. If it's only 2 generations, none of those are minor children. So 2 different generations of adults living together. So it may be you and your children and your parents living with you. It may be, in my case, it's Greg and I and our child and our grandchild living with us. Or it may mean that you're in the phase of life where you either did not have children or you had children and you raised them and they are no longer living at home, but now your parents are living in your house with you, or you have gone back and you are living in your parents' house or with your grandparents, or your grandparents are living with you. Any of those family combinations is what I'm addressing in this podcast. Now, I want to start by saying I do not, and I never have, given parenting advice. I do not think I'm the best parent. I don't think I have all the answers. I also really don't give organizing advice. I mean, I give organization suggestions. I ask you questions that make you think about what organization might work for you. But like Greg and I watch TV in our bedroom, and some people have a no TV in the bedroom policy. Some people only eat in their kitchen. We eat all over our house. Like, you have your rules. I never assigned my children chores growing up. Like, I did the laundry until they turned 18. Now they are, you know, 21 and 23, and they do their laundry just fine. Turned out just fine for us, but I never assigned laundry as a chore. So whatever your rules are that are working for you, keep them. Like, anything that I mention in this podcast are either just observational of what I've seen work in other families or what I have put in place in our family that is working for us at this time. It's not a blanket statement of like, this is how families should run, or all families should run this way, or this is the way to be successful at home. Do not read anything like that into this podcast. But I do want to be able to provide a lot of out-of-the-box possibilities and ideas that you may have never observed or you may never have thought of that really could provide tactical functional solutions for this phase of life that you either find yourself in now or may find yourself in the future. So there are a lot of ways that we end up in multi-generation households. Some that I could think of that come to mind first, like how do you end up with multi-generations in one household, is I could think of a lot of the Organize 365 community members who, in sharing in the app over the years, have either had their parents come live with them or they've gone to live with their parents and they either have finished organizing their own house or they're in the process of organizing their parents' house or their childhood home. And along the way, the needs of their parents have become greater than was available in society. And so they became the default caregiver. And for many of you, you've actually given up many parts of your independent life in order to, in this season, become the caregiver for your parents. And this is a very natural function of life. It is not talked about a lot. And often when we find ourselves in this situation where we are a caregiver, not for children, but for adults, it's extremely isolating. And I'm just so grateful to be on this journey with you at all in a podcast or videos or however we know each other. But I know it is very isolating. And anytime that you are isolated, and especially if your parent is suffering from dementia, so either they do not remember as much as they used to remember or they may not remember you at all, it is not only isolating, but it is heartbreaking. It is just so hard. It is so exhausting to be the sole caregiver of an adult. And so I just want to start by saying I recognize that, and who's going to say thank you, right? But your parents and your grandparents thank you from the bottom of their heart, and the gift that you are giving them and the gift that you're getting yourself in this experience will change you forever. As my father was sick and I knew he would ultimately pass away, I remember thinking that I just wanted one more memory with him, and I just wanted more and more experience to carry with me for the rest of my life. And sometimes when you're in this situation, there is not a clear end in sight, as there was for me. I knew this would not go on more than, you know, it didn't last quite a year, but I knew it would not be indefinitely. Sometimes when you are caring for someone, it's going to be a long road, much longer than 1 year. And so I, just as a friend, I want to say that I see you and I understand the work that you are giving to your family, and just take care of yourself. Like, I hope that these podcasts just lift you up and you feel like we are doing this together, because I am doing this with you. You're doing a great job. This is a more recent phenomenon I've seen of family members who are consciously choosing to merge households before there's ever any kind of need. And sometimes when there isn't even any anticipated need. So someone such as my age would voluntarily move in with Abby, or Abby would voluntarily, my daughter, move in with me just for, because you like each other. And it's economically beneficial to live with more families in one household. And you could share the workload of the household and the child rearing. And so I know multiple people who have sold two family homes to move into one different family home that would accommodate grandparents, parents, and children all living in the same dwelling for decades. Like, the plan is to buy this forever home, and that the people buying the home are in their late 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe early 60s, and that this is going to be like the family homestead. And in many of the situations where I've seen this happening, they actually are also moving states. I don't think that this is an isolation. I think this is a trend. I just don't have any research to show that yet. And then the third situation in which you can end up in this kind of a situation is when like just some unforeseen circumstance happens, or life just, you know, deals you a humdinger of a something, and you end up living with somebody else, or they end up living with you from circumstances outside of their control. And for a period of time, it could be weeks, it could be years, or you just happen to be cohabitating, not of a conscious design. In any case, it really doesn't matter how it is. You end up with multiple adult generations living in one house. And interestingly, as I was preparing for this podcast, I thought back upon my families of origin, and I thought, you know what? I did see this modeled to me. So my dad's father built a house in Rocky River for his family of six. My dad is the oldest of six. And as he was getting ill towards the end of his life, his wife had previously passed away, his youngest daughter came to live in his house. And she and her husband had one little baby. And they lived there for a year. And then he ultimately passed away. And now my aunt and her family still live in that house. And I remember, because I was 13 when he passed away, I'm the oldest grandchild, visiting that house when it was Grandma and Grandpa's house. I remember Grandma passing away. I remember Grandpa getting sick. I remember Grandpa passing away. And I remember when the house became my aunt and uncle's house. And I remember the decorating, because I'm just that kind of, I remember the decorating, the kids, whatever. And whenever I think about my grandpa on my dad's side, there is one picture I remember of my grandpa, and he was holding this cousin of mine on his lap. Probably would have been maybe a couple of months before he passed away. And when I think of my grandpa, that is the picture I think of. My grandpa sitting on his chair with his button-up V-neck sweater with my cousin sitting on his lap. And that is a great example of multi-generational living. Like, you just kind of did life together. Another example I could think about from my childhood, which kind of maybe informed how I'm running my household today as a multi-generational family, is that of my grandmother. So my mom's mother, this side of the family lives to be really, really old. So my mom's mother was an empty nester, and my mom's mother got remarried right before my mom married my dad. So my mom's father died of a heart attack while she was in college. And my grandmother met my grandfather, like, and got married the year before my parents got married. So a year or two before I was born. My grandfather, the only grandfather I've ever known on that side of the family, had been married two times prior, and both of those women passed away as well. He had twins with one mother and then a singlet with another mother. So when my grandma and grandpa got married, they had five adult children between them, my mom and her sister and my grandfather's three sons. And they end up buying the house that the only house I really knew as my grandma and grandpa's house until they sold it and started downsizing. And the house that they bought at the time was fairly large. It had two full bathrooms upstairs, which at the time was unheard of. This is like the 70s. And it had four large bedrooms, like a really big master suite. Now today, this is normal that you have a master bedroom that goes from the front and the back of the house, like the whole width of the house. They had that. And then they had like a dressing room, and it was great. And the bedrooms were big as well. And what was great about this was when they got married, a lot of the kids were still in college. There may have been one still in high school, but I think they were all college age or newly married and off on their own lives. And so at the holidays, we would go up to Grandma and Grandpa's house, and we didn't have to go to the Holiday Inn because there was, these bedrooms were so big that each family got a bedroom, and all of us grandkids slept in the attic, which we loved. Or, you know, wherever we ended up sleeping. It was so much fun. And in this house, for years, we would go home and we would have these holidays, and then all of these kids ended up getting older and older and having their own houses and not necessarily coming home at the holidays. And along the way, when I became older, like in my early teen years, my grandfather, great-grandfather, came to live with my grandmother. Her father moved in with her. And he got a couple of bedrooms. He had one bedroom that was his sleeping bedroom. And then he had another bedroom that was his hobby bedroom. And in his hobby bedroom, he collected coins. He collected stamps. This is the grandmother that taught me my love of jigsaw puzzles and went to national jigsaw puzzle competitions with me. So, you know, sorting and collecting was a big thing in this family. And I remember going and spending the weekend with Grandma, which I love to do because she was a great cook and she took me to her church and I just loved her church. And I would do jigsaw puzzles and I would stay in the girls' bedroom. So whenever my mom or her sister stayed at the house or anyone in their family stayed at the house, they stayed in the girls' bedroom. The boys' bedroom, which was for the three sons, had become Grandpa's sleeping room. And then the spare room had become Grandpa's den. And he lived there for many, many years. So we would go up and we would see Grandma and we would see great-grandpa. And my grandmother loved her father. I mean, she just, the sun rose and set on that man. And she loved every minute of having him in her household. And I had years of watching my grandmother and my great-grandfather living in the same household. Now, I wasn't close enough to see the day-to-day and the going to the doctor and that kind of thing, but I did see how that family transitioned from, you know, because I'm the oldest, I remember, and I'm so observant, I remember a lot of things from even when I was really little about these sons coming home with their families because none of them lived in this area. They always had to travel home to this area and their kids coming in and Emily, my sister and I going up and staying there and my mom interacting and grandma cooking and like what happened in that family. And I can almost replay the movie over the 20 years that they lived there. It's just such a great, beautiful example of multi-generational living without any children in the household. So now, when I take those two examples and I think about how we are currently doing it with a child and grandchild in our house, and I think about what I have observed in my colleagues and friends who also are in multi-generational living, here are the takeaways that I take for myself personally and our thoughts to consider if you find yourself in this situation or you want to proactively create the situation for yourself. And the first one is, we just need to normalize this. I think the fact that multi-generational living is not really seen or talked about a lot does not mean that it's not normal. I think it is very, very, very normal. Secondly, you need, or I needed, to create zones. Zones, personal spaces, and rules. Those are the three things I'm going to talk about. So zones. What do I mean by zones? In Grandma and Grandpa's house where my great-grandfather lived, it was extremely obvious that two of the bedrooms were Grandpa's spaces. Like those were his personal spaces and those were his zones. And anything that he wanted to put in those spaces, my grandmother did not have a problem with. However, I didn't find stamp collections or coin collections anywhere else in that household. It was Grandma and Grandpa's house, and it still looked and functioned just like Grandma and Grandpa's house did before my great-grandfather moved in and after my great-grandfather passed. Like, the designations of the rest of the rooms did not really change when my great-grandfather moved in, but he definitely did get ownership and definitely did get the space of those two bedrooms. And some of my friends who have cohabitated with multi-generations on purpose, I see them building like a she shed for them to work in or some designated workspace that is their workspace that's off limits for anyone else who's living in the household. Everyone definitely has their own place to sleep, their own bedroom, their own sleeping place that is their own personal space. And then I think there needs to be a conversation about what do we do with the communal zones. And I have shared before on the podcast, and I have been extremely purposeful with our daughter, Abby, about how our house has transitioned into a multi-generational family, even though she never moved out. Luckily, in the last 2 years of high school, we homeschooled her, and she voluntarily asked to move to the basement. Now we have like a 1,000 square foot finished basement, walkout, has like a little kitchenette, full bathroom. Like, it's nice. It's great. She's like, I'd like to move down there. Cause at the time she had 2 ferrets and 12 hamsters. And then she got a dog. Like, I mean, she wanted to move down there with her menagerie of animals. And I was like, sounds like a deal to me. So she moved down. And then, she's been blessed with the birth of this little baby grandson, Grayson. The pets have gone. The child has stayed. We created a little nursery down there. And when she moved down before she got pregnant and had Grayson, and she was getting ready to move into college, community college, and live at home, I did for her the same thing I did for our son, Joey, which was I moved her into adult child status in my brain, but also I moved her into adult child status in my relationship and in how we function at home. And what I mean by that is I just observe a lot. And I've observed a lot of parents with a lot of kids, and my goal was always to be a mother. Like, I just wanted to be a mother. And I wanted to be a mother who had a great relationship with her children. And I have observed that the first 6 years of life, you know, you need to do everything for your kids. And then from like 6 to 12, your kids are just, they are just such a delight to do things with. They want to do everything with the family. Like, you just make so many memories. It's just great parenting years. And then 13 to 18 are the parenting years where your children become independent adults. Like, that's what they're doing during that time. And I observed a few parents do this really, really well. And a lot of parents really struggle in this season of life. And when I observed parents who did this really, really well, I took notes. What did they do? What are they doing differently? How are they transitioning from being primary parent to adult, not friend? It's not like you have to be your kids' friends. But yeah, like, people that your kids want to hang out with, like, want to do stuff with you, and yet independent adults that have their own thoughts, feelings, desires, political beliefs, whatever, you know, independent in the ability to be the adult they are uniquely created to be, and yet want to be and enjoy being in a relationship with their parents in a different way. And so I was very purposeful about not giving answers to my kids when they were 13 to 18. When they would ask me a question under the age of 13, I would give them an answer. When they were over the age of 13, I would say, what do you think? And sometimes they would respond with something they thought, and I would say, that sounds like a great idea. Why don't you try that? And sometimes they would respond, I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. And depending on how much time I had and what the decision was that needed to be made, I would sometimes just give them an answer and they would go on their merry way. Or I would give them options, or we'd have a discussion or whatever. But I moved from responsive answering to opening up space and time to have a conversation and seeing where they were on their adulting journey. And because I was doing that so purposefully, and it was my number one goal from the age of 13 to 18, was that to assess where they were and what they wanted as an adult, to facilitate that to the best of my ability, and to give them the lifelong skills that they needed to be independent adults. Those are the three things I did for 6 years. That's it. If it wasn't those one of those three things, I did not put it on my to-do list. So here we are at 18. Abby's living in the basement. She's going to go to college locally. She's not going to go away to college. I wanted her to have the college experience. So for Joey, he went away to Columbus. From Cincinnati to Columbus is 2 hours. He went to a small school for audio engineering that did not have a campus. So we got him an apartment, and we set up the apartment for him. So for Abby, when she was going to go to community college in Cincinnati, there was not a necessity, and I didn't really want the expense, of renting an apartment 2 miles from my house so she could go to school 5 miles from the house. You see what I'm saying? Like, it just wasn't financially necessary. And also, you know, was during the pandemic. So I said, okay, I want you to recognize though, this basement is your apartment. Like, you're going to clean it, you're going to decorate it, you're going to, like, whatever, and I'm not going to come down here, I'm not going to intrude on your space. Like, when I go through the door upstairs to come down the stairs, I'm coming into your apartment. And that's how I'm going to view it from this point forward. We didn't have to worry about Greg. I think Greg's only been in the basement 4 times since we've owned this house 30 years. He just doesn't go downstairs. So that was never an issue. And after she had been living in the basement for a year or two, I took it one step further. When Abby got pregnant, I was like, okay, this really is her apartment. This is really where she's going to run her life, where she's going to raise her child, where she needs to have some independence and autonomy for me. And I went through even my storage areas and I moved my crafting supplies upstairs so that the amount of times I would actually need to go in my own basement would be limited to, you know, once on the weekend, maybe. And not, and giving her the ability to really feel like she had that space as an independent space, as an adult to herself. And so those are the thoughts that went through my mind in moving Abby to the basement and now her independently living in the basement as an adult. And I go through all of that detail because I want you to think about that for yourself. I want you to think about that for the other adult generations that you're living with. Do they really feel like they have a space in this house, even if it's just a bedroom, that is their space, that they can do whatever they want in there, they can have whatever they want in there, that they are responsible for everything that happens in that space, and you don't have expectations of that space? I don't have expectations of the basement. I really don't. A great example is, you know, I literally went to college for babies. I went to college and got an early childhood degree and a second degree in elementary education. But basically, I studied babies at the college level, which is kind of comical. I know everything there is to know about babies. I not everything, most things. I'm obsessed with babies. I love babies. I love babies. And so it would have been extremely easy for me to be an overbearing mother or to take over the parenting of my grandchild, especially since he lives in my home. And I did not. I did not. There were a lot of people that thought I would. I never did. When Abby was in the basement with the baby, I never went downstairs and just took over. The only time, if I was coming downstairs or if Grayson, our grandson, was crying and Abby was down there with him, I would stand at the top of the stairs, not very often, but if he'd been crying for quite a while, and he didn't cry much, I would stand at the top of the stairs and I would say, "Would you like some help?" And if she said yes, I came straight downstairs and did whatever, either what she was trying to do so she could take care of the baby, or I took care of the baby so she could do what she needed to do, or I just took the baby away so that she could have a minute alone. Whatever needed to be done, that is what I did. And sometimes she said no. And I just shut the door and I let her figure it out with her son as the mother, as she should. So she's in the basement with her son. She is 100% the mother. She's running that. Simultaneously, I'm an empty nester. I understand I have multi-generational living going on in my house, but I'm an empty nester. I'm getting a PhD. I'm a CEO. I want to travel with my husband. I want to be a great wife, mother, and grandmother. But also, I am an empty nester. And so I want my house to look like I expected it was going to look like when I was an empty nester. And so in order to facilitate that for myself, because the basement is now Abby's house, the second story of our house is Grandma and Grandpa's house. So when you come up the stairs from the living room into where the bedrooms are upstairs, you have entered Grandma and Grandpa's house. And I say this all the time. You know, I'll say to Grayson, "Want to go take a bath at Grandma's house? You want to go spend the night at Grandma's house?" And we come up the stairs and all of a sudden we're at Grandma's house. And Grandma's house has a PhD study room and it has a nursery for Grayson, and Grayson has a bathroom, and Lovey and Pop-Pop have a bathroom, and Lovey and Pop-Pop have a bedroom, and we have a loft where Hunter plays and Hunter's toys. And I talk about it this way. Like, this is Grandma and Grandpa's house. Now, I don't know. When he's older, he's probably just going to go wherever he goes because he's a kid and that's fine. But I say it for myself and I say it for my daughter because this is our space and she respects our space like we respect her space. Now, you may not have a situation where you can have like a whole floor to yourself, but often you can. Like in many of the multi-generational families that I know of, like there are definitely spaces that are for one family or for the other family. And then we have these communal spaces. So the communal spaces in our family is everything on the first floor. Living room, dining room, family room, laundry room, garage. All of these are communal spaces. However, I am trying my best to have them be my standard of clean and organized because it is my house. Now, I will tell you, when we think about where Abby will live independently on her own, I half jokingly say to Greg, let's give her the house and let's us get the condo. Like, I mean, seriously, this boy is going to need a house to grow up in. And are we really going to need that kind of space? But for a period of time, we don't know how long it's going to be, at least till Grayson's five. The three of us, the three generations, are going to live in one family space. So zones, personal spaces, normalizing this, I think is really, really important. And other than where you sleep and that being your personal space, if you are like, you know, wherever I do my jigsaw puzzle, that's going to be my personal jigsaw puzzle space. Like if I want to do a big jigsaw puzzle on the dining room table, then that space is going to be off limits to my grandson because this is my house also, and this is one of my passions. You see what I'm saying? So you just need to be explicit, and you need to have these discussions. And I think sometimes we feel guilty saying what we want. And I don't anymore. And the reason why I don't anymore is because I have spent the last 30 years of my life getting to this point where I can have a house that actually stays picked up for the week because I don't have little kids running around in it. I know you're laughing. I have waited to this point in my life where I could take a week vacation with my husband and not have to, you know, do all these other things. Like, I am not going to go on vacation because now I am a grandmother. And so Abby will be like, you're leaving? I'm like, yeah, you said you want to live on your own. So you get the whole house to yourself. It's like, trial run. Have fun. We all need our own places to sleep. We all need our own places to play or do our work. And then we need to discuss what the eating situation is going to be like. So I often say when you're organizing your kitchen, to think about what phase of life you are in. And we are currently in the toddler phase and the working away from home phase for Greg and I and the stay-at-home mom phase for Abby. Now, Abby has a secondary kitchen in the basement. So breakfast, lunch, snacks, all that happens in the basement. But dinners and anything involving an oven, and I don't know, she just comes upstairs whenever she wants to come upstairs. So our kitchen now, we had to create multiple cabinets that are now dedicated to toddler plates, silverware, and food. We have designated shelves in our refrigerator because Abby does her grocery shopping separate from Greg doing our grocery shopping. And then I do a Walmart order just for things that I get that neither of them get. Like we all do independent grocery shopping. So it's almost like we're living in dorm rooms. We need to have cabinets. We need to have shelves in the refrigerator and freezer that are just for us. And we need to, you know, on the weekend, everybody does all their shopping. And then on Sunday, we're like, hey, you know, I bought this. If you want to have some of this, or I'm going to make this, and then we can all eat it for dinner. Or, hey, I bought the salad for myself on Tuesday. Nobody eat it, please. Can we literally talk like this at our house? Now, recently, Grayson's gotten diagnosed with a few food allergies, true allergies. We've got the EpiPen and everything. And one of those is eggs. So right now we are even in baked goods. So right now we're eliminating eggs from everything. And now, you know, hey, I bought this, but Grayson can't eat it. Hey, you know, even when Abby made eggs the other day, his little face started to get red. So now nobody's making eggs at home. We all understand nobody's making eggs at home. And, you know, you can be frustrated because your kitchen isn't functioning the way you thought it was going to be or you want it to be. I'm talking more to myself than anyone else right now. Or you could say, I get the awesome blessing of living with my grandson. And I don't do cooking anyway, so what do I care? and your house is going to morph and change all of the time. All of the time. So that's the kitchen. Really, really having conversations about it. If you're frustrated, come up with a solution and share the solution, or just have a conversation about why you're frustrated. And in some cases, I just have to get over it. Like, there are this many people living in this house and there's only so much space. So guess what? It's not going to be the way I want it. And that's okay. I just go do a puzzle or work on my PhD or something different. The laundry room is another communal space with multi-generational living. Abby and I, even though Abby, before she had a baby, she's lived with me her whole life. It's never like she hasn't lived with me. But she does a lot of laundry. Little babies, lots of laundry. She has lots of laundry. And so I was getting frustrated because I couldn't do laundry when I wanted to, or there was always half-finished laundry in the laundry room. And our laundry room is on our first floor. Remember, in my mind, I think I'm an empty nester. I know I'm not. Anyway, I think I am. And so we, Abby and I, regularly have conversations about how we use the household together, the support she needs for raising Grayson, and when she would like us to butt out. Thank you very much. And we are constantly renegotiating the rules. And so I'm working during the week. This was before I started the PhD. I don't need to run laundry during the week. So I said, I want the laundry room from 5 o'clock Friday until Sunday morning. Like, I want the luxury of doing my laundry anytime from Friday night until Sunday morning. I said, you can have the washer dryer from Sunday morning all the way until Friday at five. She's like, great. That has worked great. Now that I'm home on Mondays and Thursdays doing schoolwork, I've started throwing in loads on Monday. I'm sure we're going to renegotiate. And once we get Grayson into daycare and Abby starts working Monday through Friday, she's going to want more time to do it on the weekend as well. So we'll just renegotiate. But so far, this has worked really, really well for us. And then I think the last piece that I want to mention about this is cleanliness standards. As a stay-at-home mom, my house was never clean. You should know it was never clean. I mean, it was clean. It was never straightened. There's just like shoveling snow in a snowstorm. There's just not enough time. I've shared this story before, but I think we cannot share this one enough. I was sitting on the floor in my family room, piles of laundry everywhere because I like to do all my laundry in one day. Joey was playing the game I call Boop in the Laundry, which is where you jump in the pile of clean clothes while I pretend or I try to fold them faster than Joey could unfold them. And my mother-in-law came over. There were toys strewn all over the house because I really like toys. Have you watched my Instagram? I bought my grandson a ride on roller coaster. Like, I love toys. Love them. So I had them everywhere. My mother-in-law comes over, sits on the edge of a chair. I think she thought the house wasn't clean. It was clean enough. And she's just kind of looking at me. And I said, what? I mean, you had Greg and his sister. Like, I'm sure your house looked like this. And she looked at me. She goes, never. My house never looked like this. I thought, oh, well, mine does. Don't worry. I felt judged. Obviously, I'm still talking about it today, 20 years later. So clearly it left a mark. But whatever. Like, it is exhausting. There's never-ending work when you have kids. And I have tried to set the standard that our house will look more like a grandparent's house and less like a stay-at-home mom house with Grayson living in it. And some months I am winning at the game, and some months I am losing at the game. And here are some of the things I have put in place so that the first floor of the house generally stays picked up and only the mess is in the family room and no other place. First of all, I installed gates to block off the kitchen family room area just like I had it when my kids were little. I had them installed into the studs in the wall. Greg was like, what about tension gates? I'm like, what about a little boy? Don't you understand? That doesn't work with tension gates. So we just screwed it right into the wall. So because those are screwed in, the living room, dining room, and laundry area, Grayson doesn't go in those areas. They stay picked up. Secondly, I have my house cleaned every Thursday. So every Thursday morning, the first floor and second floor of the house need to be picked up so it can be cleaned. Because of that, it looks great Thursday afternoon when I get home from work. Only Thursday afternoon when I get home from work, but it stays picked up during that time. So that is a one time during the week where the whole family knows dishes need to be done, toys need to be picked up, laundry needs to be finished so that the house can be cleaned. That keeps our house clean. Secondly, I don't have as many toys in the family room as I would have for my children. I don't have as many toys in the family room as I even really want to have. And I'm constantly culling the toys in the family room so that they're easier to pick up and they don't get as out of control. It's still way more toys than a minimalist would have. Nowhere near as many toys as I want to have. And I just rotate them ruthlessly. Like, I'm constantly rotating toys. And this is really easy for me to do because I have a couple of other adult friends who are donating toys to us all the time. And also, I have an Amazon account and I use it frequently. So I'll just buy new toys. So I rotate through the toys. Now, lately, Grayson's in this phase where his idea of playing is to take every single thing that he owns, put it in the middle of the room, but not actually play with it. Have you ever seen this phase before? It's annoying. So I've eliminated as many toys as possible, but also he's exhausting. Like, raising a child is exhausting. So Greg and I go upstairs and then Grayson goes to bed and I come downstairs and the toys are still out and not picked up. To date, I have not picked this as a battle. But I'm getting ready to, because Grayson's getting older and I'm trying to teach him how to put away toys. And also, I don't want to trip on things when I'm making my coffee on my way to work in the morning. So how I am going to proactively create a situation that will have our first floor of our house more straightened up more often is, are you ready? I'm buying a robot vacuum. Yes. So our house gets cleaned on Thursdays, and then the robot vacuum is going to clean the first floor a couple of days a week. Like, when we go to bed, I'm going to set the robot vacuum to vacuum the whole first floor. So when we get up, it'll be done. Mostly because I think Hunter is going to be afraid of the robot vacuum. So I'm picking, hey, if you want to tell me what kind of robot vacuum to get, I haven't gotten it yet. Please feel free to email me. customerservice@organize365.com. I don't need it to mop. I just want it to vacuum. So I want to have it vacuumed. Well, my mom and dad always said that our room was clean when she could run the vacuum. And if she couldn't run the vacuum because we didn't get our rooms clean enough, fast enough, then we had to vacuum our own bedrooms. That was the deal. If you had your room done on Saturday when she was vacuuming the house, she would vacuum your room. If you missed the cutoff, you had to vacuum your own room. So you can't leave toys all over the floor for the vacuum, right? So whatever these days are going to be, and I'm going to strategically pick these, and Abby and I will have a conversation, then it will be the room needs to be picked up on Wednesday night because the house gets cleaned on Thursday, and then it will probably need to be picked up, but I don't know what the other nights are. And then we'll run the vacuum at night, or maybe we'll run the vacuum every other night. I don't know. I haven't created the rules, but you can see how I'm thinking about this. And this is true in all of these podcasts that I'm about to record. Your home needs to be organized differently, and you need to establish different rules for yourself for all of the different phases of life that you go through, and also the different people and peoples that are living in your house with you. And so these are some of the questions and considerations you can have when you are living in a multi-generational home. So I want to leave you with specific organization. How do the Organize 365 products tie into this phase of living? For the Sunday basket, a Sunday basket is like your backpack or your purse. It is your personal possession. No one should take anything out of your Sunday basket. Now, it's kind of like a mailbox. People can put things in there or requests that they have for you, but they shouldn't be going in and sorting. Like, you don't have multiple people sorting through the information in a Sunday basket. Greg has his Sunday basket. I have my Sunday basket. Abby now has a Sunday basket. It's wonderful because then I can put mail in there, and then on Sunday, she goes through hers. So however many adults you have, you need that many Sunday baskets. And if you are in the first scenario that I mentioned, where you are caretaking for your parent or your grandparent, and they are unable to take care of their financial and medical needs anymore, you still need a separate Sunday basket for them so that you can process through your household work and tasks and then their household work and tasks. I suggest a portable for them. For the paper solution, the different binders that you have in a household, the household reference binder, which is the binder for everything of the household that you would sell, you only need one per household. So if you're all living in one house, you only need one household reference binder because that's where you would find the information about the roof and the washer and the HVAC and all the other things. It's all in one. If you have multiple houses, you have one per house. Each family member needs their own medical binder. You will only have one financial binder per head of household. Now, if you are in the first scenario where you're living with your parent or your grandparent, they have a financial binder and you have a financial binder. Even now, Greg and I have a financial binder and Abby has a financial binder. And then for the operations binder, that one is really like pets, vacations, holidays, recipes, cleaning schedules. It's your lesson plan book for being a homeowner. You would have that for your household. Now, if the other generations of people who are living with you, I don't know if they're going to want to keep track of all those, but if they do, they would have their own lesson plan book. Like, think about yourself in a school. If there are two teachers in a school, they don't teach from the same lesson plan book. They each have their own lesson plan book. And I think that this is important because you're going to be sharing a lot, but you don't need to be sharing your brain. So keep your own Sunday basket, keep your own binders, only share the binders that you need to, because the thing, the house for the household reference binder, there's only one roof. There's only one HVAC unit. Like, you have to share the information on that. But you may have different recipes than other people. You may have different cleaning schedules. You may have different pets, actually, than other people. So that would be in your operations binder. And of course, everyone would have their own workboxes for all of the work that they do. Okay, I think that's all I have to say about this. In the next podcast, we will explore a different configuration of people's living in a household.